Sports. It's as American as apple pie. We Americans love our sports, and it's not surprising that our presidents have been fans too. But even something like sports has become part of the political landscape. For decades, presidents have appeared at sporting events, and championship teams and gold medal winners have been invited to visit the White House. Athletes have become vocal about their political views and often endorse candidates for office. This wasn't always the case, and our listeners might be surprised to know that Richard Nixon was a pivotal figure in the nexus between American politics and sports. In this episode, as part of our series on Richard Nixon, we'll find out more about his role on America's cultural landscape.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
Hello, we have this superb podcast called We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by Billy Joel.
It is the most original, fascinating, and random way to learn the story of the 20th century.
Oh, pretty darned random. And we are joined by some pretty incredible guests.
I only wrote stuff that I wanted to hear. If it turned out to be a hit, it was pure dumb luck.
With me, Katie Puckrick.
And me, Tom Fordyce.
This is We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Today's guest is Professor Nicholas Sarantakis. He is a historian and an associate professor in the Department of Strategy and Policy at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He's the author of the book Fan in Chief, Richard Nixon and American Sports, 1969 to 1974, where he talks about President Nixon's passion for sports and his unlikely role in sports history. As our listeners know, we're in a series on the Cold War, and we're currently examining Richard Nixon. And people love to psychoanalyze Nixon and are sometimes surprised to learn about some of the personal details of his life, that he, like millions of his fellow Americans, was a huge sports fan. So Professor Sarantakis, thank you for joining us about this subject.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the meat of your research, one thing stood out to me, and that was that Nixon had lost his brother at a young age, and this is kind of a deeply personal thing that happened. And there's a moment where he actually talks about the impact that had on him. And so when did he say this?
He said that in 1972 during a radio interview that he gave that was related to his releasing his list of the greatest baseball players of all time. And he opened up about one of the players that he had picked, who he called Profiles in Courage, reference to Lou Gehrig, but he was talking about someone who had battled tuberculosis. And he opens up about his brother's death. John Farrell, who wrote a brilliant Nixon biography, gets to it in his book, but I actually had Nixon saying it. So, you know, sometimes history works in little increments, but that was, I thought, really important because he finally came out and said what I had always expected was the truth.
And there's kind of this parallel with President Kennedy, his brother. He had lost his brother, and a lot is known about that. Not as much is known about Nixon, but it's kind of this moment where he kind of allows kind of a peek into the behind the curtain.
Yes. And for some people, losing a sibling is, you know, a life-altering event. And, you know, I lost a sibling. It happened very early in my life, so it was not as life altering for me. But if you've, you know, if you're 12, 15, 19, 22, it could be detrimental or just a big watershed moment. So it's traumatic. Understandable. Traumatic, could alter how you do things. And I've certainly had deaths in my life that have changed my personality, my goals, my how I want to live my life. So, yeah, I mean, that's just something that makes them human.
Right. Now, it's very interesting that you decided to take on this subject about Nixon's love for sports. And I've seen the list of books that you've published, and a lot of them are hard Cold War topics. So what got you into this aspect of his life?
Nixon released a list of the greatest baseball players of all time. He did it in 1972, and he was like picking the greatest first baseman, the greatest second baseman, and so forth. And what he did, he was at a press conference, and he was asked, can you pick, you know, your greatest players? And he picked two guys who were first basemen, and he said, well, I'll get back to that. Never mind. And the reporter kind of kept pushing and said, well, sir, if you came back in a week, could you do it? And by this time, Nixon had already kind of presented himself as, you know, sports fan number one. He had started doing some things that people found a little odd at the time, which we now take as kind of given. He was the first person to, or the first president to call teams after they won the big game. He was the first president to invite teams to the White House, which now seems quite commonplace, but at the time it was, what's the president doing calling me? And John Wooden, the great UCLA basketball coach, said one of the highlights of his career was when Nixon called him. So he's started doing this kind of sports fan number one thing. The reporter kind of pushed and said, well, sir, you know, if you do this, can you? And Nixon said, well, okay. And he spent a week of his time. He spent a week in June of 72 putting together this list. And I'm like, thinking, what in the world is a president of the United States doing basically playing fantasy baseball? And the answer was, it was politics. June of 72, it's baseball season, but it's also a presidential election year. And what I discovered, or what is very apparent up front, is instead of just picking the nine greatest players of all time, he picked a team for the American League, and he picked a team for the National League, and he picked a team pre-war and post-war. So he ends up picking four teams, and it's not four teams of nine. It's okay, here are my starters, and then here are my reserve players and my pitchers. So he ends up picking a lot of guys, and you start looking at it, and it's like, wow, you know, he needs a Polish American, he needs, you know, a Hispanic, he needs an African American, you know. So this was a exercise in political theater, and it got my attention, and I was like, what's going on here? Well, I was always gnawing at this, and I thought, you know, this is really interesting, and it gets to why Nixon gets himself elected over and over again, or at least gets himself on a national political ticket five times. The only person who's done that other than Nixon is FDR. So some people say it's Nixon as a political animal, but it's also Nixon knows how to connect with the American people. And one of the ways he did that was he presented himself as a sports fan, which he was. And it was always in the back of my mind. When Nixon died, there were all these people on talk shows calling in, praising him, and it all focused on foreign policy. No one talked about his domestic policies, and no one talked about him as a politician. So I said, you know, there's something here. And I ended up writing a dissertation on an important topic in U.S.-Japanese relations. But while I'm doing my dissertation research, I'm like at the National Archives, which at the time was where the Nixon White House records were kept. And I spent an afternoon saying, well, let me look at this. And they're like, they bring out the file, finding aids. And it's like, oh, okay, there's a sports file, which really was about the equivalent of two file cabinets worth of memorandum and telegrams and documents of various sorts. And there was a lot on the baseball team. So I grabbed all this stuff, and actually I wrote an article on this before I wrote my dissertation. So it was something I started when I was in graduate school, and I just kind of kept at it. And when I went back to the National Archives, I said, you know, let me grab all this stuff. I spent 3 weeks doing research, and it was great. And I there was a lot of good stuff there, but there was, I needed to get other stuff and I went to other places and boom, I said, there's something here. I'm seeing a different Nixon.
That's fascinating because in hindsight, post Watergate, Nixon's name has been associated so much with not just the scandal, but kind of this persona of being almost like this sniveling, paranoid ogre of a human being. And in some ways, there's some truth to that. You know, when you listen to the tapes, there's a lot of crudity and things of that nature. But you brought up the way he was on the national stage for so long. And so you have a man who somehow was successful in such a public career. And also, in addition to that, something as mundane that we take for granted for now, presidents invite sports teams over to the White House. I don't think I didn't know that President Nixon started that.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And it's just an example of him. Some of it's political theater. He's being very calculating. But also some of it is just genuine. I'm a sports fan. I want to hang out with these cool guys. I want to tell them I really enjoy watching them and they're my heroes. And it's both. And with Nixon, you can't dismiss one or the other. You have to, it's the whole package.
Right. So talking about Nixon's own personal relationship with sports growing up, what sports did he play growing up? What sports did he love that he was passionate about as opposed to those he didn't care for?
Well, pretty much what it is baseball and football. Those were two sports that he really was fond of. He played college football at Whittier, where he went to his undergraduate, and he was basically a tackling dummy. He never actually lettered in the sport, but he was the kind of guy who just get up and try again. He wasn't very big. He didn't have a big frame. He didn't have a lot of weight. So, but he was kind of like, come on, guys, let's go. And that inspired other teammates. He was like, oh, I pulled a muscle. And it's like, well, you know, Nixon would love to get in there. He's trying as hard as he can. You know, don't be a wimp. Get in there. So he was this great spark plug for his college football team. And actually, it's kind of funny. The college, Whittier, gives him a letter in football just before he becomes president. So he eventually did letter. He just had to get himself elected to the White House. So, you know, I guess it's kind of difficult to get an athletic letter from Whittier College. But he was a big football fan, and he loved baseball and professional baseball. Which, you know, at the time really was the national pastime. He watched it, or he didn't watch it. He mainly followed it via radio and newspaper. He doesn't get to see a game in person until he's out of law school.
Okay. So what's interesting that you mention is he had relationships with some of the greatest names in sports history. We're talking about the Ted Williamses, the Vince Lombardi's, these legends. So can you tell me about those relationships and how did they come about?
Some of this is a mutual admiration society. One of the interesting relationships he had was with Jackie Robinson, the great Brooklyn Dodger who desegregated baseball, was the first African-American player to play in the major leagues. Nixon, most people don't know this, was actually a member of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which in the 1950s was quite liberal. Robinson admired his, you know, stand on civil rights. And in 1960, Robinson endorsed him for president and even campaigned for him. And they remained, I'm not sure what the right word is, friends strong sounds a bit too strong, but they were close, at least professionally, for about 16 years, and then they had a falling out over civil rights. So that was one of them. Another relationship that Nixon developed really after he loses the presidency in 1960 and then a run for governor of California in 62, moves to New York. He becomes friends with Frank Gifford, who at the time was a legendary player for the New York Giants. Most people remember him now as being a sports broadcaster, but a great player. He was also from Southern California, played for USC. So there was a connection there. You mentioned Ted Williams. Williams was a Republican, certainly right of political center. There was a mutual admiration society. And most people forget this, but Ted Williams after he played baseball, he quit sport for a few years, and then he came back and was a manager for the Washington Senators, and then goes and is the manager for the Texas Rangers. And the team moves from Washington to Texas and changes their name. But he, the first year that Williams was a manager, was the first year that Nixon was in the White House. So there was kind of like, boom, you know, these guys are there. Another relationship that he had was Vince Lombardi. He really admired Lombardi. And if you've ever studied Lombardi, he's a great coach, but he's also, there's a lot more to Lombardi than just being a great coach. He's almost this semi-philosopher. I mean, he's an incredible individual. And believe it or not, Nixon actually considered picking Lombardi as his vice presidential pick in 1968. He kind of has serious second thoughts about it when he learns that Lombardi is a rather big-time liberal and was actually supporting Robert Kennedy. But there's a lot to Lombardi's character and his personality, and he was something more than just being a football coach. So there are a number of relationships there. And what's interesting is there are examples of players. There was one player who said, I want to meet Nixon. And he just, this is after Nixon's out of office, and he goes to his residence and basically, you know, says, hey, how's it going? And I'm going blank on the guy's name, but he says, I'm so-and-so, and Nixon lets him in. Boom, you know, and they end up chatting. So, and there was another time when he met Gail Sayers, and they ended up just chatting, and, you know, it was kind of like, wow, this is really interesting relationship. So essentially, if you were an athlete or you were a coach, you could get access to the president of the United States quite quickly in a way that most Americans can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounded like he was somebody that loved to be seen at sporting events. And what were some of those big sporting events that he attended? I think one thing you mentioned was that it was almost like he would make these cameo appearances at these big games. You know, people know that he made the cameo appearance on the show Laugh-In, but apparently he was kind of a fixture at these games during his career.
Yes. Nixon, particularly at first year in office, he goes to a lot of Washington Senators games. He goes to a, and that was, he'd show up and it was just, I'm a fan, I want to go. So there was a lot of that, particularly in the first year. And for the first time in a very long time, the Washington Senators are winning. They don't get close to the playoffs. Playoff structure in baseball was very different back then, but they're winning. And they were a doormat team for a long time in the American League. So suddenly it's like, Senators are winning. And if Nixon ever had a team, it was the Washington Senators. So he goes to those, and he has this thing, I never leave until the last out. And I've been to a couple games, and I've like, wow, the lead changed between, you know, the top of the eighth, the bottom of the eighth, and then the top of the ninth. And I was just like, okay, I understand why Nixon said that. You know, at the beginning of the eighth inning, it looked like one team was going to win. And then, you know, it's very dramatic. And given the structure of the sport, it can dramatically change. So he would always go to Senators games. He would sit in the stands and just be one of the fans. He was not one to go in luxury boxes or sit on the sidelines. He also went to an American Football League game. People forget that the American that there were two sports, there were two football leagues at that time. The American Football League eventually merged with the National Football League, but he went to a Oakland Raiders Miami Dolphins game, and he also went to a Washington Redskins game. So he went to a number of games. One of the more famous ones that he went to was he went to the 1969 University of Texas, University of Arkansas football game when the Longhorns and the Razorbacks were ranked first and second in the country. So they were essentially playing not only for the Southwest Conference title, but also for the national championship. And he shows up and he sits in the stands. And I have a whole chapter on that. Other people have written whole books on it. So that's very dramatic, a very famous thing. And then he goes to a couple other things. He goes to the 1970 All-Star game, and he goes
baseball.
The 1970 baseball All-Star game. So there are a number of times when he goes to these kind of events. He was not a big fan of basketball. Some of this most people don't know this, but he had two fake teeth. He had had his teeth knocked out in a basketball game, and you know, kind of was averse to the sport ever since.
Traumatized by basketball.
Yeah, yeah. He went to the 1932 Los Angeles Summer Olympics and said he was bored out of his skull. So he really wasn't interested in, you know, track and field sports. And to be honest, most Americans aren't. So they are during the Olympics, and then they tend to forget about them. So those were the kind of sports that he was interested in.
That's interesting, because the sport I'm most familiar with is basketball. So I remember reading that Wilt Chamberlain, one of the greatest NBA players of all time, was a Nixon supporter.
Yes, he was. And Nixon watched a Lakers game, and it's actually caught on tape. He's like, wow, they were majestic and all this sort of stuff. And it's interesting. And then he basically doesn't go to another game for about almost 20 years. He finally goes to another NBA. He goes to an NBA game in the early 90s. And Duke is also winning in sports in the early 90s. They're winning, going to the Final Four. And since he went to law school at Duke, he's now a Duke Blue Devil fan. So he kind of adopted basketball, or at least got a little interested in it late in life.
Sure. Now, you talk about his desire to and maneuvering to try to get the Olympics in the United States, especially the 1976 one for the bicentennial. Could you talk about that and what happened?
Yeah. Los Angeles wanted the Summer Olympics, and they wanted the Summer Olympics in 1976. And the story of Los Angeles getting the Summer Olympics is long and complicated. But the long gist of it is the people trying to organize the Olympics in Southern California had some contacts at the White House. One of them had been in business with H.R. Haldeman, who's White House chief of staff. So they contact Haldeman and basically say, hey, we're in a contest. And oh, by the way, one of the other cities bidding for this is Moscow. So whether you like it or not, we're in a contest with the Soviet Union. Well, that got Haldeman's attention. He takes it to Nixon, and that got Nixon's attention. And they basically said, we got to do this. Now, the Nixon administration makes some really big fundamental mistakes in trying to do this. They assume that the International Olympic Committee is an athletic version of the UN. So they start lobbying ambassadors, and they say, okay, and there's actually memo traffic where they say, you got to go to the Belgian ambassador, the Italian ambassador, the French ambassador, and squeeze them and make sure that we have the vote of Italy and France and Belgium for the 1976 Olympics. Okay. Well, there are a lot of problems with that. One of them is that the International Olympic Committee is a private organization. It is not a representative organization. The people who get on the committee are selected by current members of the committee. There is no rule that every country in the Olympic movement must be represented, and many are not. So, for example, one of the rules is that unless your country has hosted the Olympics, only one person from that nation may be on that. So there is only one Irish member of the IOC, and actually today there might be no members. There are two British members because Britain has hosted the Olympics. There are two French. There are two Americans. Okay, so... okay, got that. Since it's a private organization, most of them don't have contacts with the governments. Now, this is during the Cold War, so the East German Olympic Committee and the Polish Olympic Committee and the Soviet Olympic Committee, et cetera, yeah, they do what their government or the Communist Party tells them to do. Okay, got it. But you can go lobby the ambassador, and he's goes back to the foreign ministry, you know, write some telegrams. They come back and say, yes, we support it. But that doesn't mean that you've got the French guy on the IOC voting for the Olympics. So they kind of learn painfully these lessons. And Haldeman assigns a guy to basically be in charge of running the Olympic effort. His name is Charles Stewart. And he basically is learning the Olympic movement at the same time. And he basically proposes, Nixon and Haldeman agree, that they should bribe members of the International Olympic Committee to get their vote. And there is memo traffic. It's in Haldeman's files. They bribe members of the IOC. They don't actually give them individual, like, here's $10,000. But it's like the Panamanian on the committee wants this. So they give, you know, track programs. So bring in some track coaches to get trained at USC. The Nicaraguan member or the guy from Nicaragua wants this. So give him that. And it was like, they want to have Nicaraguan athletes compete at in some athletic event in the United States. So it's kind of most of the bribing, and I'm putting that in air quotes, is basically not personal bribes in the sense of here's, you know, graft that you can put in your bank account, but it's bolstering the athletic programs in their countries. Okay, long story made short, the IOC votes in 1970 to give the 76 Olympics to Montreal. And there's a reason for that. There were only three countries that want, excuse me, there were only three cities that wanted to host the Olympics in the entire decade of the 1970s. They are Montreal, Moscow, and Los Angeles. And in 1970, the IOC did not want to be forced to pick between a U.S. city and a Soviet city. So they pick a Canadian city. Well, fast forward 4 years later, there are only two cities bidding to host the 1980 Olympics, Moscow and Los Angeles. Okay, well, the IOC has to bite the bullet and they pick Moscow. And then 4 years later in 1978, there's only one city that's bidding to host the 84 Olympics, and that's Los Angeles. So the IOC didn't really care, or the bribing of IOC members didn't really make a difference. The Nixon administration learned quickly, you know, how the structure of international sport is done, something that the Carter administration, when they decide to boycott the 1980 Olympics, didn't understand and doesn't learn. So,
and you wrote a book on that topic too.
Yes.
Which could be its own episode too, or its own interview.
It could be.
That's fascinating. So, this is very simplified, but it seems like, Nixon had a harder time with the international Olympic landscape than he did getting to Mao and to Brezhnev, apparently.
Yeah, because it's structured differently. There are, I forget what the magic number is today, but there's something like 187 members of the Olympic movement. They each have their national Olympic committee. Some of those are not nation states. For example, if you are a citizen of the United States, you can compete for one of four national Olympic committees. You can compete for the U.S. Olympic Committee, the Puerto Rican Olympic Committee, the U.S. Virgin Islands Olympic Committee, or the Guam Olympic Committee. Now, with three of those, you actually have to be resident in those pieces of real estate. But or you can, if you're on one of those places, you can just go compete for a spot on the U.S. team. So they do not necessarily correspond to the nation state. And there are many, like I said, many nations that are not represented on the IOC. And it's not a federal system. The people who are on the IOC are picked by other IOC members. It's much like a country club or a yacht club. So, and there are many people, many nations, if you want to call it, representing. And again, I'm putting that in air quotes. They're not on the committee. And in fact, the committee likes to say that the members of the committee are ambassadors of the Olympic movement to their home nation. Okay. And I'm kind of saying that sarcastically. A lot of the people on the committee are rich and powerful. The rule of thumb is you have to have such status that the head of state returns your phone call within a day. I'm here to tell you right now, today, the members of the U.S. Olympic Committee, the Americans on the Olympic Committee, the IOC, probably could not get their phone call returned within 24 hours. And I suspect that was probably the case in the 70s when Nixon was there.
Hmm. So you mentioned the Washington Senators, at one of the teams that Nixon supported. You've also said that Nixon was kind of a floating fan. He would support some teams different times in his life, and he also moved around. So who were his teams?
Essentially, he had kind of this philosophy of, I'll root for the home team of wherever I'm living. So for a long time, he was a fan of the Rams after they moved from Cleveland to Los Angeles, because he's from Southern California. While he's in politics, he's a fan of the Washington Senators. And the Senators stay in Washington until 1972. Excuse me. They leave in 71. They become the Texas Rangers in 72. So he's a big Senators fan while he's in Congress and while he's vice president. He moves to New York in the 60s after he loses the election in 1960 and his run for governor of California in 1962. So he becomes a New York Giants fan. He is a New York Mets fan, particularly after he moves to New Jersey, after he's out of office. When the Senators leave D.C., he basically has to find a new home team, and at least in baseball, that is the California Angels. There's an interesting conversation between him and Haldeman about why he's not going to pick the Dodgers, and it was basically he was afraid that the fans at Dodger Stadium would be more Democratic than Republican, and he felt he had a safer bet of getting a warmer reception in Anaheim than he did in Los Angeles. So, and he's a Washington Redskins fan for a number of reasons. A big Redskins fan when he's vice president and when he's president. And he also kind of adopts the Miami Dolphins as his home team because he has a residence in Florida for a time. So those are kind of his home teams.
Yeah, there's a famous photo of him. Well, I don't know how famous it is, but I've seen a photo of him with, I think, with the Orioles, and they're celebrating in the locker room, and Nixon's getting champagne or beer poured on him. It's such a, I think it was with the Orioles, but it's such a funny image of him because I think he's even in his suit, but then, you know, and the Orioles are celebrating, and then there's Richard Nixon. So I don't know. Have you seen that photo?
No, I can't say that I have, but that makes complete sense. I mean, Nixon was, for whatever reason, an awkward, stiff, clumsy guy. And that's just how he was. And I have seen video of him walking into locker rooms, and he gets a little relaxed when he's in the locker rooms. And then when the cameras go on, he becomes the stiff, awkward Nixon that we know and love or don't love. So I'm not sure why it is, but he enjoyed this, and he was not a particularly gifted athlete, and he doesn't try and make himself into an athlete. He's not trying to, you know, play pickup games of basketball the way President Obama did with some guys when he, you know, with White House staff, or, you know, when he's touring military bases. Nixon was presenting himself as a fan, and he had no problem saying, sitting in front of a television watching it, but he did get opportunities to, you know, interact with the athletes. And, you know, it was kind of for him a little bit of a Walter Mitty fantasy.
So I had lived in D.C. for a while, and I have a lot of friends who are Redskins fans. And you talk us about a story when he visits the Redskins locker room. Can you talk more about that episode?
I think you're referring to the time he visits the practice.
Oh, yes. The practice. Yes.
Yeah. So the Redskins had been an underperforming team for many years. They hire Vince Lombardi. People forget this. Lombardi stopped coaching the Packers. He's out of football for a year or two, and then he decides he wants to coach. He goes to the Redskins. They win for the first time in like a decade. And then Lombardi gets sick with cancer and dies. One of his assistants takes over. They revert back to form. They get rid of him, and they hire George Allen. Now, Nixon loved George Allen. George Allen had been the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams, but before that, he had been the head coach of the Whittier college football team. So there's a Whittier connection, and he loves Allen. Allen comes in, and he turns the team around again, and they start winning. And everyone's loving it because the Redskins are winning, and, you know, people love a winner over a loser. Okay. So they're going on a tear. It looks like they're going to enter in the playoffs, and then they just get humiliated by the Dallas Cowboys. Okay. And this was at the beginning of their run dominating the 1970s. So Roger Staubach's their quarterback, Tom Landry's the coach. They're humiliated at RFK Stadium in DC, and they're booed. Well, Nixon had a deal with George Allen that he would come visit the practice at some time. And Nixon realizes, boom, this is the time I need to come. So he decides to go. The only person who's informed about this is George Allen. And the first time the players realize that Nixon is visiting them is when they see him walking across the practice field. Okay, even in D.C., the president of the United States visiting your practice is a big thing. And these guys are demoralized. Their fans have turned on him. And he basically sits there and says, listen, you've done good for this city. It's a city that doesn't have a lot of bonds. A lot, people come and go. You are a unifying force. We are behind you. And, you know, he's trying to deliver a message. There were a couple angry people there. You know, forget them. Don't worry about them. And then, you know, people are like, wow, and George Allen's manipulating the situation. He's getting people to pose for photographs. It turns out, I mean, a lot of the guys on the Redskins are not Republicans, and some of them don't want to pose pictures with him and stuff like this. But for the most part, Nixon really isn't trying to do anything political with this. He's just trying to be a good fan and kind of bolster their spirits. And George Allen calls him and says, this was fantastic. You did great work. And the White House tapes are fantastic for phone conversations. So, you know, I listened to that conversation, and, you know, Allen is just telling him, you did great stuff. You turned it around, et cetera, et cetera. So they go back on a tear and they start winning. So, and this gets a lot of attention at the time. Their pictures on the front page of the Washington newspapers. There were at that time two newspapers, not on the front page of the sports section, on the front page of the paper. And it gets a lot of attention, and Nixon feels pretty good about it. So, and he just chats with people, and Nixon, his only hobby is sports. So he's like talking to people and saying, hey, I remember you played at Duke, and now you were there a couple of years after me, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, and he's just talking to the players, and they're like, wow. So even if you're not going to vote for him, it's still pretty cool to have the president come visit. And in that sense, you know, people put aside their politics and they just say, wow, this is cool. This is neat. This is, you know, this isn't happening to the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, he was a real, it sounds like he was a genuine sports junkie. And today he would have been a fantasy football, fantasy basketball, or maybe not basketball, fantasy baseball person.
I think, I think so. I mean, one of the things he did was when he went to a game, he actually had the box scores and he'd fill it in. And he said it helped follow the game. And, you know, this is a guy who actually knew what he was talking about when it came to the sport of baseball and football. He was not just a, you know, fan. It was the one thing. And I mean, he could pull stats and say, oh yeah, I remember him. He played for University of Miami. And they're like, oh my goodness, how do you remember this? Well, if it's the only other recreation that you have, boom.
Right. Now, did he have much of a relationship with John Wooden? I know you've mentioned him a little bit here and there.
No, not really. In fact, one of the NCAA tournaments is played in College Park, and no one goes to that. A lot of his main subordinates are UCLA Bruin Bears or alumni of UCLA. So, no.
Okay.
Wooden, I know, votes for Nixon, but other than a phone call and a letter, that's about it.
And I think you also mentioned Joe Paterno, the Penn State coach. What was that relationship like?
Very minimal. And some of this goes back to 69. One of the things, and I did my undergraduate at the University of Texas, so I have no problem with what happens. But my cousin went to Penn State, and he does. At the end of 1969, there are three teams that are undefeated. Texas, Arkansas, and Penn State. Penn State in the 1960s and 1970s is still up and coming. It's East Coast football, which is always kind of diminished. You know, the real power football is in the South. It's in Texas. Texas and Arkansas are established football powers. Both have faded a bit over the years. But the system that was in place was basically the news polls or news associations. The Associated Press and United Press International had polls that ranked the teams. Those tend to favor established football powers. So since Penn State was kind of up and coming. It's had a weak history. They didn't get the benefit of the doubt. So they had finished undefeated in the previous year, 1968, and they didn't get the national championship. They finished second to Ohio State. Well, when the season starts, they're below Texas and Arkansas and Southern California and Ohio State. Well, all those teams lose except for Texas and Arkansas, and then Arkansas loses to Texas at the end of the season. So what you have is an undefeated Texas Longhorn team that Nixon goes into the locker room after that game and gives them a plaque and declares them national champs. Joe Paterno's sitting there going, hey, wait a minute, my guys are undefeated. We're going to the Orange Bowl. What's going on here? Hold off. Okay, well, at the time, the system was whoever is number one at the end of this end of the regular season is the national champ. And it changes a little in the 70s and 80s, so whoever's number one at the end of the bowl season is the national champ. And this is just by voting, by journalist voting, so it's not really determined by play on the field. Sometimes a little. Paterno is really kind of peeved about that, and he's like, I got an undefeated team. We've gone undefeated 2 years in a row. Come on, give me a break. He meets with Nixon. Nixon invites him to the White House a year later. Paterno has the good decency not to mention it, but he gives the commencement speech in 74 to Penn State. He cracks this line. It's like, wow, President Nixon knows a lot about football. Too bad he doesn't know a lot about Watergate. And he gets this huge laugh. And it's a great line. I think it's in the book, but and it's better than what I just said. But even though Paterno was kind of a right-of-center Republican voting kind of guy, he was not particularly close to Nixon, and he had a bit of a grievance, if you will.
Hmm. So Nixon is the president who signs in Title IX in 1972, major civil rights legislation promoting women's athletics, basically changing women's athletics in the United States. How did that come about? What did he think about the legislation? It seems like he's kind of an unlikely figure in that story.
He is, and he has very little to do with it. Most of this is done by Congress, and it's kind of funny. It tells you how the American people kind of give the benefit of the doubt or kind of gravitate to the White House. Most of the work was done by members of Congress, their staff, etc. Nixon had very little to do with it. The bill comes to him. He signs it. He signs it because he's not about to veto a civil rights bill. Now, he looks at this. He looks at Title IX, and the story of Title IX is no one really foresaw what it did. Okay, the ramifications take about 2 or 3 years to really fully develop. Well, Nixon saw what was coming, and he said, this will kill college football. This will kill college athletics. And in a sense, he's right. It doesn't kill college football because college football makes money in a big way, and they pay for a lot of the other sports that don't make money, including a lot of the women's sports. But what happens is a lot of schools suddenly have this mandate, and what it comes down to, there's a bit more to it than this, but essentially if you give 100 scholarships to men, you have to give 100 scholarships to women. So one of the ways that schools deal with this is they cut programs that are not popular or that are not, you know, have a lot of people involved. So instead of like giving 100 scholarships to women, what they do is they cut the track team, they cut the lacrosse team, the golf team, and they lower it to say, we now have 60 scholarships. So we'll give 60 scholarships to guys and 60 scholarships to women. So they kill a lot of men's sports to get around having to raise the number of women's sports. So Nixon saw this. He was afraid that it would really damage football. It doesn't because of football's money-making power. But he signs it anyway. His attitude is, I'm not about to veto a civil rights bill. And here's the thing. When we talk about Nixon, we have to kind of separate the sound from the substance. So he's a great campaigner, and he seems to, at first glance, have a rather bad record on civil rights. But he never vetoed a civil rights bill, which is something some of his predecessors can't say. And when he comes into office, he throws an incredible amount of money at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And it goes from having a budget of something like $25 million or $50 million to over $1 billion. Okay. That's a billion with a B. Okay. So a lot of people are like, oh, he's opposing busing. Okay. Maybe. He nominates a couple of judges who were not the best on civil rights, but he empowers his Justice Department in a very big way. So when it gets to Title IX, he sees what's coming and he still signs it, even though he doesn't like it. So complicated legacy.
So after doing this research, writing this book on Nixon, after studying his history with sports, how has this changed how you view Nixon, and how do you want people to look at him with this knowledge about him?
I spent about 6 weeks listening to the White House tapes, and that was a blast. It was actually one of the highlights of my career, because it's like the West Wing, except it's real. Okay. Now, it's 50 years later, but it's real. And Nixon comes across as a very smart guy. He knows his politics. And in one sense, you go, what happened? Why Watergate? It's so stupid. At the same time, I'm clicking and going to these various conversations, bouncing around, and you can hear him just plotting some of the most malicious things in politics possible until fairly recently. Nixon is a complicated guy. I think he's human. There's a lot of substance to him. He does a lot of good. He does some damage too. And I think if what really you have to do is just look at him in the whole picture. In many ways, he's a one-man Greek tragedy. The very skills that got him to the top of the political profession are the things that bring him down. His ability to personalize things, his ability to never say quit. So it's a very complicated story. So I think you see Nixon more or less at his best when you see him interacting with sport. But you also see the damage that Watergate did, because he pulls himself away from this area. He doesn't interact in social policy the way he did with Title IX, the way he did with a couple other things. So I think, when you look at him through this venue, you see a lot of strengths of the guy, but you also see some of his weaknesses. And I'll just leave it at that.
It sounds like it adds to kind of the complex tapestry of his life and his story.
Nixon is a very complex guy, which is just like saying Nixon breathes air. Nixon does a lot of good, and everyone I've met who worked with him love him. With that said, George Lucas, who creates Star Wars, models the evil emperor after Nixon. So there's good, there's bad. And I enjoyed listening to the tapes. It was a blast, but sometimes you just go, why did you have to do that? Why? Mm-hmm. And then in one sense, it kind of breaks your heart. I mean, it doesn't seem like it had to be that way. So mm-hmm. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, thank you. The book is called Fan in Chief, Richard Nixon and American Sports, 1969 to 1974. Professor Sarantakis, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
This American President is produced by myself, Richard Lim, and Michael Neal. If you like what you've been hearing, you can help us by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. We are a proud partner of Evergreen Podcasts. Check out evergreenpodcasts.com for more shows you might enjoy. I'm Richard Lim. We're back next time with more This American President.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.